And welcome to another episode of Colored Red, a podcast that's all about Colorado true crime. I'm your host, Laura. And I'd like to take just one moment to remind all you guys that there is a Patreon for this podcast. And all you have to do is donate $1 per month. And that will get you a sticker and a handmade card from me. And the objective of those funds is to get more merchandise for you guys and more perks. So just $1 per month, and that would be a huge help to me. If you don't want to pay any money and you want to also be a huge help, head to iTunes and rate and review the show if you like the show. That would be everything to me. So thanks, guys. I'm also going to try something next month with sharing some scary stories from Colorado. So if you have a nonfiction story or a fictional story even, send it to me at coloredredpodcast@gmail.com. And let me know if it is true or not true before I can really read them. And let me know if you want your name shared on the podcast, because I sort of want to do my version of a creepypasta, basically, and tell everyone stories and get those out there. And so if you have Colorado-related scary stories, whether you were camping and something weird happened or anything like that, please shoot me an email, coloredredpodcast@gmail.com. You can also send it to me on the Facebook page or on Instagram at Colored Red Podcast. So the story I have for you guys this month is a story from 2001, and it has some similar elements to it that we've already talked about before. It involves a man who murdered his family and then reported them missing. And he goes on live television to plea for their safe return. But really, it's kind of going to become obvious that he knew exactly what had happened to them. The police didn't immediately suspect him, though, and the case was still ongoing with a retrial in 2018. But we'll see exactly what happened with that case and exactly what happened in that retrial and what caused it. This is the murder of 34-year-old Jennifer Blagg and 6-year-old Abby Blagg by their husband and father, Michael Blagg. On November 13, 2001, Michael Blagg called the police to report that his wife and daughter were missing from their home in Grand Junction. And at first, he indicated to the police that he had just sort of walked into this empty house. The back door was open when he walked into it, and he started to notice that things were off, and he felt odd about the entire house situation. Apparently, their master bedroom was on the first floor, and that's what one report said, but other reports might have stated otherwise, and I couldn't quite figure it out. But he's saying that he's walking through this house and he's seeing papers strewn around, and he makes his way into the master bedroom to see this gigantic pool of blood on his wife's side of the bed. Both his wife and his daughter are not in the home. He reported that he had been trying to call home throughout the day and getting an answering machine at his house. He also came home to all these papers, and what he also saw in the master bedroom was Jennifer's purse, basically dumped out on the floor of the bedroom, but no Jennifer. Police indicated that the amount of blood at the scene was indicative that someone was dead, and so I looked into it a little bit more. A human body that's roughly 150 to 180 pounds holds 4 to 6 liters of blood. You need to lose 40 to 50% of that in order to basically be considered dead or be very near death at the very least. So I looked up just what 2 liters of blood looks like when it's kind of tossed onto a bed, and it's enough blood to soak almost entirely the top of a twin bed. And I have a picture of the blood on the master bed that's dripping down onto the floor, and I'll be putting that on Instagram for you guys to look at. As I stated before, Michael Blagg went on TV to make this heartfelt plea for his wife's safe return, and he repeatedly pled with the community for any information about the disappearance of his family. He did many of these pleas with the family of Jennifer standing right beside him, so he had a lot of support starting out.
My prayer is that through this and through maybe somebody that saw something in the last couple of days, that we can bring Jennifer and Abby home, because that's what we all want. We just want them to come home.
How have you been dealing with this?
This has been as draining and as physically demanding as anything I've ever done in my life. And it's truly a horrible situation. And I know that the Lord will bring me through this, and the Lord will bring them home.
During this time, police conducted searches of nearby rivers and forests, and they found absolutely nothing. About a month later, the family of the Blaggs put up $3,000 as a reward for information in the case after it's revealed that the blood in the bedroom did in fact belong to Jennifer. Michael Blagg tells investigators and friends that he's bothered that he's a suspect in this case. And it's sort of a point of contention that he never really assists in any of the searches, but he's always maintained that the police sort of didn't want him to participate in the searches because he was a suspect. The following year, in 2002, in April, a very large search is organized with 200 volunteers per day, and they search a 45-mile radius around the home for 11 days, and they turned up absolutely nothing after these 11 days. Then in May, investigators turned their search to the Mesa County landfill. Only 2 days after this search, Michael Blagg basically left Colorado without telling police where he was going. Then shortly after this in June, investigators discovered the body of Jennifer Blagg in the landfill, and it just so happened to be in and near trash that came from the company Michael Blagg worked for. An investigator described the scene as this: the bucket of the digging equipment came out of the ground, and right there in front of everybody and onlookers, a leg fell out of the pile of trash that was being pulled up. Her body was wrapped in a red and black camping tent, and the autopsy revealed that Jennifer had been shot in the head. The body of little Abby has not even ever been located to this day, nor has there ever been any evidence that she was even killed, because there was no blood of Abby's found in the home or on her bed. And that's not without a large effort. After investigators found Jennifer, they searched the landfill for nearly 7 weeks and sifted through 7,000 tons of trash, and they still couldn't find her. Prosecutors then charged Michael Blagg with first-degree murder. And they found him living at his mother's house in Georgia, and they found him because they revealed that they actually did follow him when he left Colorado, and they had had police following him for a very long time to make sure that they watched what he did and where he went. And that's about all there is in terms of information inside of articles in this case. But in the arrest affidavit, it's revealed that Jennifer was abused in the marriage and was seeking help. And she wanted to end this marriage just days before she disappeared. And so the arrest affidavit, which I'm going to discuss in length, reveals a lot of new details about the dark home, about the Blagg family. So who were they really? The Blagg family lived in this very suburban two-bedroom home inside a quiet cul-de-sac in Grand Junction, Colorado. They were described as this absolutely picture-perfect family, and they had a number of professional shots done and hung around their home. And I'll be posting a number of these professional photos on the Instagram for this case. Their reverend ended up describing them as this incredibly happy couple, and that they were perfect together, and they were described as extremely enthusiastic born-again Christians. Michael Blagg met Jennifer 10 years prior in California. He had been a helicopter pilot in the Gulf War and was a decorated veteran when he met Jennifer in college. And after they got married, Abby arrived only 3 years later, and she was their only child. So what we have here is the picture of this incredibly happy, down-to-earth family. They love the Lord. They're born-again Christians. They have supposedly a very tight moral compass and some tight activities that they do that are sort of all in the same realm. So basically, they're not the type to go out and party, and they're not the type to really have a ton of enemies in the community. And so here is exactly what Michael said happened that day that his wife and daughter disappeared. He left around 6 a.m. and he left his wife and daughter sleeping to go to his job as an operations manager at Amatech Dixon Company. He made a series of phone calls home that day to leave messages.
Good morning, gorgeous. It's me. Just calling to see how you and Abby are doing.
Love you, sweetie, and I'll try calling you back later. Y'all take care. Bye-bye.
And he called home at 7 a.m. and said, "Good morning, gorgeous. It's me. Just seeing how you and Abby are doing." And he says it's not super unusual that Jennifer didn't pick up at 7 a.m., Maybe they were in the process of getting ready because Jennifer had to take Abby to school that morning. He called again mid-morning asking where they are, but he sounds really peppy and just wants to know what they're up to. He called at noon and said, "Hello, my beautiful bride. Hope you're having fun. Hope you're out and about doing all kinds of cool missy things." And he says he's getting worried. He calls again around 3 p.m. and asks where they are, saying he loves and misses them. And then he arrives home at 4 p.m., sees the back door wide open, walks through to the papers in the purse, and sees the large dark spot of red on the bed. Before looking for his daughter, he calls the police and sort of starts looking in his daughter's room during the call.
911, where's your emergency?
Oh my God, it's at my house.
Okay, what's going on?
I just got home from work and there's blood all over the bed and there's stuff all over the floor. My family's gone, my daughter and my wife are here.
And here is part of the call that Michael Blagg made to the police that day. So Michael Blagg tells investigators this whole story, and as he's telling them this, the crime scene is starting to reveal some stranger things about Michael Blagg and their home situation. There was no sign of a struggle, and there wasn't really any sign around the home that this was a normal attack type situation. Nothing in the home was out of place whatsoever other than the stuff in the bedroom that was tossed up. The contents of Jennifer's purse were spilled out, and inside were keys to the van that was parked inside of the garage. There's a jewelry box that's turned over and emptied, but nothing else in this home was taken. So why murder this family during a robbery, especially to murder a woman lying asleep in bed? And to the police, this entire scene looked staged. In Michael Blagg's interview with the police that day, he was incredibly calm and collected. There was really no sense of panic in how he was acting, and there was no real sense of grief either. Even in interviews on TV, he's incredibly calm, like he's ordering in a restaurant or explaining directions to somebody. He literally just has this incredibly put together and calm way of talking, even about his dead wife and how happy they were. He looks like he's just sharing some information about how his day was. This doesn't really make him guilty, but it does come across as way too calm after seeing this blood pool from his wife. He's sort of seen lounging back in his chair during the interview that day, and he crosses his legs, and he just appears incredibly put together. More details about the crime scene and Michael's activities are uncovered. A neighbor comes forward to state that she heard the strange noise around 1:30 a.m., and it must have been a really loud noise for someone to hear it in the next house over. None of these houses are connected. They're your typical cul-de-sac houses that are about 10 to 20 feet apart from each other. Another neighbor says that he awoke around 2 a.m. to his normally quiet dog barking like mad outside. Michael also kind of had a weird day at work that day, and they uncover all of this after talking with his coworkers. Work colleagues of Mike say that it was actually really unusual for him to be at work that early, and that it seemed like he was really hovering around other employees a lot that day, and basically just being seen. One employee states that Michael came into the docks some like 20 to 30 times that day, and that's an area that he's normally never in. At one point, he even went around and emptied all of the personal trash cans as a favor to literally everybody working in the company that day, as if to really just be seen. Another colleague sees him pushing a pallet jack containing two large boxes, and he asked Michael if he needed help, and he said, "No, just get away." And this is from a guy that's normally incredibly jovial and kind and nice to everybody, and they said that his demeanor that day was just off. Other colleagues report that Michael ate lunch in the company workroom that was fairly unusual for him to do. He pretty much rarely to never ate lunch in that community break room. Someone else at work that day said that Michael actually came up to them and asked them for help in scanning a picture of himself, Jennifer, and Abby for a Christmas card that year. A man working at Amatech Dixon says he ordered the trash compactor emptied and picked up the following day, but he denies that Michael ever told him to do this. It was just time for it to be emptied, and that's probably just a coincidence. And finally, another neighbor that day also said that she saw Michael driving home from work and that he was driving very, very slowly through the neighborhood, which is why it caught her attention and she remembered it. Jennifer's mother tried to reach Jennifer that day to talk about her mother's ongoing cancer treatment, and she couldn't reach her, and she never got a call back from her, which she said was incredibly unusual. A friend of Jennifer's also tried to reach her that day and didn't get her on the phone either. The blood in the bedroom is Jennifer's, but for whatever reason, there isn't a single trace of blood anywhere else in the house except for in the bedroom. And the only other place outside of the house where this blood is located is in the family van, which was parked in the garage. There were small traces of it on the door and inside the van, and they really only ever described this as just little droplets of blood here and there on the outside of the van and inside the van. Investigators then began to focus more heavily on Michael Blagg. At first, he paints a perfect picture of the family. He moves on to admit that Jennifer found out he was addicted to hardcore porn and that she was mad, but according to him, Jennifer wanted to join in with him on the hardcore porn sites, and he claims that they used the sites as, quote, educational tools, specifically to learn more about oral sex. And this didn't really sound right to the investigators. Here's a guy who used to be a bit of a partier in his younger days when he was in the military and did traveling. And he's telling investigators that he and his wife watched hardcore porn so that she could learn how to give him oral sex. Michael Blagg claims that she wanted to do this because she had a hysterectomy, and I'm assuming he means that she wasn't particularly interested in sex anymore. Because you can still have sex with the hysterectomy, but maybe she just wasn't into it. Investigators interview Michael for 10 hours, and at this point the FBI gets involved. And in an incredibly startling series of events, after this final interview for 10 hours, Michael tried to commit suicide and was found in his bathtub with pictures of Jennifer and Abby and his wrists slit. He also left a suicide note indicating that he had nothing to do with their disappearance and or deaths. He survived the suicide attempt, and people have had really varying ideas on what this means. Some people believe it means he's guilty, and other people think it means that he's not guilty. And really, before the end of this episode is up, I'm going to give you my thoughts on this case because it's a rough one. At one point, Jennifer's mom agrees to help investigators by leading a series of voicemails on the home machine, demanding information about Jennifer and Abby, and those calls went unanswered. So at this point, investigators had this working theory that he had shot his wife and then suffocated his daughter and then put them into the trash compactor at his job. And that's the hunch that they used to end up searching through the landfill. And some people may not realize this, but landfills use this grid system, and they kind of have meticulous logs of where certain routes are dumped, and where trash from a particular place was dumped in the landfill can be narrowed down to a pretty close proximity. And so that's where they started searching for Jennifer's body, and that's when they found it. Michael has his own theory for what happened, and he says that someone saw the family while they were out and liked his daughter and then snuck in, killed Jennifer, and took Abby for themselves. So it is his suggestion that Abby is actually still alive and that some creep off the streets came in and killed Jennifer so that he could take Abby for himself. Nevertheless, Michael Blagg was arrested in 2002, shortly after his wife's body was found. His defense attorney, Frank Daniels, said that the police focused pretty heavily on Michael Blagg and they never really entertained any other theories. So let's get into the really nitty-gritty details of this case that were in the arrest affidavit. I have that here, and it does detail a little bit more about that scene the day that police arrived there. And I'm going to hit kind of the main important points that I see in this arrest affidavit. It does confirm that Michael had called 911 and said that he saw the back door open and the papers on the floor and the blood. Yet when police arrive, he's standing out front and he has to give them keys to the house because everything but the back door is still locked. I'm not sure where Michael supposedly entered the home and why he would have locked it back up unless he went out of the garage, which had an indoor connection to the inside of the house, and to the back door immediately, which is very suspect because it's like, if you've got an entrance from your garage into the house, why are you leaving the garage to come in and exit through the very back door leading to the backyard? Deputy Tim Orr would make the observation that a lot of the blood was dry and not really coagulated or sticky, but dry on the furthest points out from where it originated. And he sort of makes this wide sweeping conclusion at that time that the blood must have gotten there 3 to 4 hours prior, and even up to 24 hours prior, it could have been there. Investigators thought it was strange that Michael had almost a list of things in the house that he thought were tampered with. Even silly stuff like 2 pillows were on the bed and 1 was on the floor. And everything in this mental list he apparently made after looking at the scene once, supposedly distraught, ended up being everything that was out of place in the house. So if you go into your home and find this bloody mess in the bed and your wife and daughter are missing, it really seems odd to make a mental note of where the pillows are and have a really detailed list in your mind of everything that was off in the house. And that's the only things that actually end up being off. So it's not like he just missed that the basement was destroyed or that anything else was amiss in the house. He just immediately knew everything that had been turned up. This affidavit also does mention his coworkers and their statements of his odd activities that day, and they described him as on edge when he's normally put together. The Colorado Bureau of Investigation and the Mesa County Sheriff's Office searched the home, and they took video of their search. They found some clear liquid droplets on the floor of the foyer, and they noted that they found blood droplets inside Jennifer's minivan in the garage and on the outside of the van, but with no significant splatter in the bedroom or in any place leading from the bedroom. There's just a large pool of blood in the bed on the floor. They note that they even used luminol to try to find blood that was dragged through the house and cleaned up, but they couldn't find anything. And what they noticed was the blood stain in the bed was really described as unusual. It had coagulated around the edges, but there was much fresher, wet, clear fluid in the center of the stain, indicating a separation of the blood after being there for some time. The blood was dripping off of the bed and was completely dried on the floor. And a couple of investigators noted that it seemed more blood or liquid had been added to the center of the stain later on to make it appear fresher instead of super old. So basically, there was one fall of the blood that spread out, and then someone came in later and dumped more blood in the center of it that was slightly newer. They noted that the bed was unmade in Abby's room, but there was absolutely no blood in Abby's room. They noted the overturned purse and jewelry box, some change from the purse was lying about, and the contents of the jewelry box were gone. Nothing else whatsoever in the house was tampered with. A forensic pathologist came to the scene and determined that the amount of blood seen would lead to a death or very, very serious bodily injury, leading to death in an adult if it wasn't treated immediately. And that was their initial conclusion. This was before Jennifer's body was found. That was their initial conclusion that she must be dead, basically. The last person other than Michael Blagg they found who spoke to Jennifer was a neighbor who spoke with her in the evening before they supposedly went missing around 8 p.m. Eventually, throughout the investigation, a woman working for Colorado Legal Services claims a woman matching Jennifer's description came into her office with a young girl seeking help with domestic abuse and seeking a lawyer. She described the woman as very scared, and she later identified a picture of Jennifer from a selection of pictures and Abby, saying that they were, without a doubt, really, maybe 1% doubt, the mother and daughter who had come into her office. So basically, if we were to take her word for it and her memory for it, Jennifer had come in with Abby to her office seeking help leaving an abusive marriage. And curiously, a different set of neighbors were leaving on vacation to Las Vegas the morning of this disappearance day. And they said they saw a woman with a stocking cap on who matched Jennifer's description, who they thought was Jennifer, walking across the street from the Greenbelt to the Blagg home with this intense, deranged, cranky look on her face. So you might want to just ask, you know, was this Jennifer? Was she out cooling down after a fight with Michael that morning? Was she out for some other reason? Was this literally moments before she went inside and was killed? And I'll describe why probably this was not Jennifer here in a bit. Michael Blagg himself suggested that they use a retainer case used by his wife to match DNA to the blood evidence found. According to Michael Blagg, Jennifer wore a retainer to bed and removed it in the morning and put it in this case every single morning. The case was found without the retainer in it, furthering the idea that Jennifer had actually not been up and that she was shot while she was still asleep. Later on, a toothbrush and hairbrush would be used to match the DNA. The sheriff's office received a tip from a woman working for an escort service who believes Michael Blagg visited her service 2 to 3 times per month. He would usually visit between 11 a.m. and 2 p.m. and be wearing business attire. He would often get a topless massage and a hand job. The woman from the escort service remembered that he mentioned he had a daughter, and on one occasion he stated that he was mad about a shoebox he found in the closet at his house with writings and letters in it written by his wife. This box was never found. Several other women in the escort service also identified Michael Blagg as a customer of their services. A retired FBI profiler was also engaged in the affidavit and gave a statement that he was 99% certain the crime was not a random killing on the basis that the body removal takes time. And he says strangers who just sort of randomly are coming in to kill as a part of another motive do not usually bother to remove the body from a scene, especially if everything left over is evidence that something did happen. And given the crime history of the neighborhood, or lack thereof, the likelihood of this being some random violent crime goes way down. And so if someone else perpetrated the crime, it was targeted specifically at the Blagg residence and was not random. The agent described Jennifer and Abby as low-risk victims of random violence, and he says that they were definitely the target of something personal. He also waited on the crime scene. The pooling of blood and lack of struggle to him indicated that she was shot while she was in fact asleep. He described why he felt the crime scene was staged. The fact that the only overturned item was the jewelry box and the rest of the house was not even ransacked or touched was an indication of someone wanting to protect the rest of their own property while still making it seem like a robbery took place. A true robber isn't going to care what they overturn or destroy in the hunt for valuables. And once they have already killed somebody and they have all the time in the world they feel, they're going to go through the house and make sure that they search everything. He indicated that the water droplets in the foyer could be evidence of some cleanup, but that can't really be determined. He said that as a rule of thumb, body removal from the crime scene indicates that there is a relationship between the victim and the perpetrator. The affidavit also says that investigators were able to determine when the Blagg's van was last fueled and that it was filled the last time it was fueled. They had several known locations that Abby and Jennifer went in the van since that date, and they determined how much fuel was left in the van and found that there were about 91 miles of travel unaccounted for in the missing fuel. And so it was that 91-mile round-trip theory that they used to do that 45-mile search radius around the home. They indicate that no other fingerprints have been found on the jewelry box or purse contents other than those of Jennifer and Michael Blagg. So in February of 2002, the affidavit says that Michael Blagg is seen removing furniture and items from his workplace. Investigators ask his supervisor if he had permission to remove those items, and at that time, they were reported as stolen by his supervisor. And so in an interview, they ask Michael about these items and he denies taking them. And they're like, well, we found them in your house. And so at that point, he admits that he stole them. And one of these items was a paper shredder. And it's never really determined why he needed that paper shredder. They also confront him about the porn on his computer, which he denies, and then later admits to viewing. At first, he says the porn is also enjoyed by his wife, but later admits that they actually fought about the porn quite a lot. He also steadfastly denies seeing the sex workers. He's asked if he fought with his wife the Friday before she went missing, and at first he denies that as well. And then he admits that they fought about an employment opportunity in Longmont. And he sort of just downplays this argument, and we'll see a little bit later why him saying that this argument was about a job doesn't make any sense at all. At one point during the interview, Michael breaks down and he's lightly sobbing, and an investigator asked him to tell him the truth about Jennifer, and Michael Blagg reportedly said, "I can't," and kept responding, "I can't tell you," and then changed it to, "I really don't know where they are at." After this interview, an investigator came to retrieve more stolen items from Michael's home that he stole from work, and this is when he found Michael Blagg in the bathtub with his wrists slit, which he later recovered from. A friend of Jennifer's came forward to say that she talked with Jennifer 10 days prior to her disappearance, and that Jennifer actually asked her to pray for her regarding a problem that she was having, and that she would tell her about it, but not then, because it would have been upsetting to her friend. The same friend also said Jennifer was planning to come visit her in South Carolina with Abby, but not with Michael. And the friend stated that this was really odd, and that there was really no way that Michael would have ever agreed to let them go for an extended amount of time on a trip without him. She also said that she thought it was an indication of marital problems between the two of them, that basically Jennifer wanted to get out of the house. The proximity of Jennifer's body to articles with Amatech Dixon printed on them and known items that were produced as waste by Amatech Dixon, these items were very close, if not directly underneath, Jennifer's body. The excavator being used pulled out Jennifer's body, and then two bucketfuls later pulled out paperwork that belonged to Amatech Dixon. So it's either highly coincidental that she was dumped with Amatech Dixon trash or right on top of it, or she was disposed of in an Amatech Dixon dumpster. It's noted in this affidavit that Jennifer's retainer was still inside of her mouth. And so we're going to bump onto the trial here. In the first trial, Jennifer's mother is no longer defending Michael Blagg. The prosecution started by laying out the events of that weekend leading up to the crime. They say that the couple fought on Friday, and they used this book of prayers and guidance as evidence where Jennifer hand wrote a note on the side of the book saying, "Fought with Mike on Friday," but there's really no date on this note, so I'm not really sure what this prosecution's bit's all about. They claim the murder occurred the night before he left for work on Tuesday. Prosecutors claim that the porn addiction basically was what the huge source of strife was in their marriage, and that it was splitting them up. And the prosecution also details the method of death via gunshot to the head. It explains the trajectory matches one in which someone shoots her in the head while she's essentially laying with one of her cheeks on the bedroom pillow. The defense cannot really explain the blood in the van. They really go through some effort to sidestep explaining that at all. And the defense says the entire case is circumstantial and that the murder weapon has never been found. And multiple friends take the stand to give character witness statements for what an amazing and doting husband Michael is. They state how emotional and sad he was following the disappearance, and that he's just incredibly stoic in the presence of other people. And they say that when he was with them, he would break down and get incredibly emotional. So they say that him not showing any emotion is no indication of his guilt. Then in this really surprising move that took everyone off guard, Jennifer's mother took the stand and says that Jennifer had called her one night in the past to tell her that Michael had tried to hurt her and choke her. And everyone in the courtroom just sort of stopped and was shocked by this. And Michael and his lawyer maintain to this day that Jennifer's mother completely made this story up in an attempt to get Michael convicted. And is it possible that Jennifer kept this a secret? But if we're going to take the woman at the Colorado Legal Services for her word, it seems that Jennifer and Abby came to seek help with a domestic abuse case and that this could have been going on. And the friend also verified that she felt something was going on in the house. Michael decided in this first trial to not take the stand, and his defense lawyer instead curiously used this email found on Michael Blagg's computer, written to Jennifer but not sent. The date for this email, get this, was the day that they had went missing. So that day that he's bumbling around work and emptying people's trash cans and scanning pictures of his family, he's also writing this ridiculous email. And it stated thus, "Jennifer, I love you, and I'm sorry that we have ruined this day and the opportunity to spend our lunchtime together. I don't know what went wrong. My intent was to spend a wonderful time with you and coincidentally get some Christmas shopping done. That obviously went horribly astray. The Lord tells me to not let the sun go down on my anger, and so I won't. You are the light of my life. I ask for your forgiveness for any wrongs I have done to you, and I also forgive the wrongs I have perceived against me. I do not want us to waste another weekend being angry with one another. I would love to take some time today to talk through the problems we are having. I will send this as an email, and also I will bring it home to you." After Paul says to not let the sun go down on our anger, he says, "Do not give the devil a foothold." Ephesians 4:27. "I am sorry if I have given the devil a foothold. I will always love you." So in this first trial, Mike is found guilty of first-degree murder, and he's sentenced to life in prison. He and his lawyers file multiple appeals over the coming decade, and they are all denied. After a decade in 2014, his conviction was actually overturned due to juror misconduct. This juror that was in the first trial had denied on her survey being a victim of domestic violence. And so lying on your jury questionnaire is seen as perjury. So for this reason, Michael Blagg gets another trial and brand new lawyers. And this trial was moved to Jefferson County in Golden, Colorado. Before the trial, the defense attempts to bring forth some evidence that there was potentially another perpetrator of this crime. They identified a man named Philip Breensma of Whitefish, Montana as the killer, claiming that Breensma had Jennifer and Abby Blagg's name written on a list of his victims. Philip is now serving a 100-year prison term for child pornography and sexually assaulting a child. The judge denied this evidence in the trial, saying that it just isn't sufficient. The prosecution also tries to bring in a 2001 gas leak in the Blagg home as proof Michael tried to harm his family before, and the judge denies this in the trial as well. So in the trial, the lengthy interview tape was again played for the jurors, and this time with certain audio enhanced where Michael talks out loud when investigators leave the room. An audio expert determines that he says, "Please, please, please find them," and then he says, "Find them again." And there are definitely cases where people do and say incriminating things in interview rooms when officers leave. I think it's possible to know at this point that you're being recorded in this room, and you could try to say things that make you look upset or worried. I think that Michael is incredibly calculating in this entire case and does a lot of things to try to make things appear a certain way. So I don't really take this stuff said in this room to heart. In February 2018, the second trial is underway, and his family again testifies that Michael does act very stoic in public, but around them he was sobbing and upset. And Michael's demeanor is a big talking point in this trial. The defense claim that his overly long 10-hour interview was a psychological trick to get him to say things that he didn't mean. But I'm curious what they think he said that was incriminating. He really just is steadfast on his story in this interview. The prosecution claims that he was given training in the military for how to respond to investigators. And none of this is really ever verified or checked up on. And Michael Blagg this time actually takes the stand himself. And he testifies for 2 hours about his love and devotion for his family. And after 17 hours of deliberation, the jury finds him guilty of first-degree murder yet again. So this jury finds him guilty yet again, and he claims that the idea that the husband always did it ruined his trial. So while I sort of think that he has a point about current mindsets and trends ruining trials, do I think they really ruined his trial? Not really, but I'll just go on the record and say I hate the shirts that say the husband did it. Evidence is always king. So is Michael Black guilty of this crime? It wasn't until I pulled up this arrest affidavit detailing more of the evidence and his actions that I really made the decision that I think he is. But I do wish that there was more physical evidence available because I feel like more was discussed at trial that just hasn't been revealed because this trial just ended in 2018. And I also don't think that the Philip Bruinsma guy is completely excusable. A lot of convicted rapists and murderers, they lie about the scope of their crimes. And if he went to the trouble of making up a list of victims, it's possible he put Jennifer and Abby's names on it because he heard them on the news. Lots of convicted rapists and killers have claimed that they did a ton of different crimes that it's proven that they couldn't possibly have done. And I'm not sure if Bruinsma being in Colorado at that time was ever looked into. If he did do it, then the upcoming list of things I'm about to discuss make even less sense because I'm going to break down why I think that Michael Blagg's the only person who could have possibly done this crime because a lot of stuff about this home and this entire case just don't make a lot of sense for anybody else to have done it. The phone messages that he left on the answering machine are weird. Was it normal for him to check in that much, or was he just doing this because he couldn't get a hold of them? It comes across as incredibly clingy, if not a method of control, that he wants to know where she is and what she's doing every couple of hours. If I were at home and I were a stay-at-home wife taking care of things, I would be incredibly annoyed if my husband called home every couple of hours to check in on me and see what I was doing. In the phone messages, he doesn't indicate that his wife normally had lunch with him. Like, hey, you coming to lunch? Why didn't I see you at lunchtime? He doesn't say anything about lunch. So there's no indication that he was calling because she missed a lunch date with him. He just really seems to make it a point in the phone messages to call her gorgeous and his beautiful bride. And personally, I don't really find it that romantic or cute. I think it's just a little bit weird. Pieces of his interview, he seems to say things that try to obviously set him up as this super loving and caring guy who's missing his family. And here are some direct quotes from his interview. At one point he says, "We're talking about the two most important people in my life are missing right now." And he says things like this incredibly calmly and unpanicked. He also says, "Through the strength of the Holy Spirit, I am able to be standing." He corrects himself, "sitting here in front of you right now. Every fiber, every corner of my body wants to scream out and shout and grab somebody by the neck and say, 'You did it,' and tear them limb from limb." And while this is very poetic and dramatic for an off-the-cuff saying in an interview, it seems to me like a canned response that he thought up prior to the interview. I mean, who talks like that just normally while they're in a state of panic over their wife being missing? In interviews with the news, like in a 48-hour special, he says, "This has been as draining and physically demanding as anything I've ever done in my life. It's truly a horrible situation, and I know that the Lord will bring me through this, and the Lord will bring them home. Anyone who knows anything about my wife and my daughter, I pray that they will come forward. Just allow them to come home. That's all I ask. Please allow them to come home." And he says, "I had everything. I was on top of the world. I had a great job, wonderful family, incredible wife and daughter. Everything was going perfect for me. It was a wonderful love story. I was in the Navy. I recognized that there was something special about her." And this might be a stretch for me to say. It sounds like he's just incredibly focused on himself here. And he doesn't say we were on top of the world and we had a perfect life. He says I, and he says me quite a lot in his interviews. And then there's that work email on his computer. He sure did a lot of worrying and fawning over his family that day. Maybe he's doing all this to try to deflect blame and show what a great husband he is. But it seems incredibly put on and coincidental that he leaves all these phone messages and writes this email on his computer that day that they go missing. So Michael told investigators that this email was about a fight they had on Friday over a job opportunity. And here's a quote from this email again. Quote, I ask for your forgiveness of any wrongs I have done to you, and forgive the wrongs I have perceived against me. I am sorry I gave the devil a foothold. So does that sound like an argument over a job opportunity to you guys? He also was basically made this effort to be seen scanning a family photo on this day as well. So the emails, the family photo, the calls home, he's really putting it on that he's this loving and doting husband. In the 911 call, Michael mentions that his daughter's school clothes are still laid out. I think it's been pretty much established that Jennifer was shot while she was still asleep. Michael didn't say at any point that one of his tasks was to lay out his daughter's clothes on her bed while she was still sleeping in it. So who laid out the clothes? Were they laid out by Michael afterwards as a part of this staging? Jennifer was shot while she was still asleep, so she didn't lay out the clothes. So based on the staging, if Michael didn't do the crime, then what was this perpetrator's motive? Was it to take the daughter, or was it to rob them? Michael's theory is that a random stranger saw Abby and wanted her, so then what's with the emptied jewelry box? Would a robber kill Jennifer and go through the trouble of disposing her body for the contents of a jewelry box? And if someone took Abby for ransom, would he bother with killing Jennifer and then disposing of her body? And then where was the ransom call? Where was the note? If it was for ransom, it doesn't make any sense. None of this stuff makes sense. I think Michael Blagg made this valiant effort to stage the scene and appear like an incredibly loving husband and be seen as much as he possibly could be seen at work. He also made a serious effort to always talk about them in the present tense in interviews. So I think he's a calculating guy, and I think he's thought this through, which is why he did all of this during that day. But unbeknownst to him, it made him appear incredibly suspicious. And Michael's family still stands by his innocence to this day 100%. Personally, I wish there was more direct physical evidence in this case, but there's so much circumstantial evidence that it starts to become absurd to think that anyone other than Michael really did this. Why would that person have gone to the trouble of disposing of Jennifer and Abby? And why would they only steal from that one jewelry box? Were they targeting this family? How likely is it that Jennifer's body ended up amongst the trash from Michael Blagg's workplace? Can Michael account for the blood in the van or the miles driven that were unaccounted for? He claims their marriage was fine and had some tiffs, but the dramatic email and Jennifer's ominous words to her friends and her visits to the domestic abuse office indicate that there was something deeper going on in this house than typical squabbles. So what do you guys think? I'm going to be posting a discussion group about this case on Facebook, and I'll also post about it on Instagram, and feel free to weigh in to me with your thoughts on this case. And also, again, send your spooky stories into me at coloredredpodcast@gmail.com. And you can also message me on Instagram with this. Depending on how many I get, if I get any at all, I'm either going to do the mid-month episode or a bonus episode or an end-of-the-month episode about the scary stories. So let me know. Until next time, everybody. Thank you.